The online comments section of the New Haven Independent is full of East End folks lamenting how the elements from poor neighborhoods like Dixwell and Newhallville are finding their way into our perfect hamlet. By elements, of course, they mean black people. You look surprised, Ruth remarks. No, I reply quickly. It just happens to be where I live too, and I've never seen you around. I keep a pretty low profile, she says dryly. I clear my throat. Do you have relatives in Connecticut? My sister, Adisa. She's the one who's sitting with Edison. She lives in Church Street South. It's a low-income apartment complex in the Hill neighborhood, between Union Station and the Yale Medical District. Something like 97% of the kids live in poverty, and I've had my share of clients from there. It's only a handful of miles away from East End, and yet it's another world. Kids selling drugs for their older brothers selling drugs because there aren't any jobs, girls turning tricks, gang shootings every night. I wonder how Ruth wound up living so differently from her sister. Are your parents still alive? My mother works on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Ruth's eyes slide away from mine. You remember Sam Hollowell? The TV network guy? Didn't he die? Yes, but she's still the family maid. I open the folder with Ruth's name on it, which has the indictment that was handed down by the grand jury and that precipitated her arrest. I hadn't had time to scan anything more than the charges before this moment, but now I skim with that superpower that PDs have, where certain words leap off the page and lodge into our consciousness. Who's Davis Bauer? Ruth's voice gets softer. A baby, she says. Who died? Tell me what happened. Ruth begins to weave a story. For every thick black fact she spins, there is a silver flicker of shame. She tells me about the parents and the supervisor's sticky note and the circumcision and the emergency C-section and the newborn's seizure. She says that the man with the swastika tattoo who spit at her in the courtroom was the baby's father. Threads knot around us, like the silk from a cocoon. And the next thing I knew, Ruth says, the baby was dead. I glance down at the police statement. You never touched him, I clarify. She stares at me for a long moment, as if she is trying to figure out if I can be trusted. Then she shakes her head. Not until the charge nurse told me to start compressions. I lean forward. If I can get you out of here, so you can go home to your son, you'll have to post a percentage of the bail amount. Do you have any money saved up? Her shoulders square. Edison's college fund. But I won't touch that. Would you be willing to put your home up? What does that even mean? You let the state put a lien on it, I explain. And then what? If I lose the trial, does that mean Edison won't have anywhere to live? No, this is only a measure to make sure you're not going to skip town if they let you leave. Ruth takes a deep breath. Okay, but you have to do me a favor. You have to tell my son that I'm all right. I nod, and then she nods. In that moment, we're not black and white, or attorney and accused. We're not separated by what I know about the legal system and what she has yet to learn. We are just two mothers, sitting side by side. This time, as I walk through the gallery of the courtroom, I feel like I've put on corrective lenses. I notice onlookers I didn't pay attention to before. They may not be tattooed like the baby's father, but they are white. Only a few are wearing Doc Martens. The rest are in sneakers. Are they skinheads, too? Some hold signs with Davis's name on them. Some wear powder blue ribbons pinned to their shirts in solidarity. How did I miss this the first time I came into the courtroom? Have they assembled to support the Bauer family? I think about Ruth walking down the street in East End and wonder how many other residents questioned what she was doing there, even if they never said it to her face. How incredibly easy it is to hide behind white skin, I think, looking at these probable supremacists. The benefit of the doubt is in your favor. You're not suspicious. The few black faces in the room stand out in harsh counterpoint. I walk up to the boy Ruth acknowledged earlier, who immediately stands. Edison, I say. My name is Kennedy. He is taller than I am by nearly a foot, but he still has the face of a baby.
Is my mama all right?
She's fine, and she sent me out here to tell you so.
Well, you took your sweet time, says the woman beside him.
She has long braids shot through with red, and her skin is much darker than Ruth's. She is drinking a Coke, although there's no food or drink allowed in the courtroom. And when she sees me looking at the can, she raises an eyebrow as if she is daring me to say something. You must be Ruth's sister.
Why? Because I'm the only nigger in this room other than her son?
I reel backward at the word she uses, which I am sure is exactly the reaction she's going for. If Ruth seemed judgmental or prickly, then her sister is a porcupine with an anger management problem. No, I say, in the same tone I use with Violet when I try to reason with her. First of all, you're not the only person of color here. And second, your sister told me you were with Edison.
Can you get her out?
Edison asks. I focus my attention on him. I'm going to try my hardest.
Can I see her?
Not right now. The door leading to chambers opens and the clerk enters, telling us to rise as he announces the judge's return. I have to go, I tell him. Ruth's sister fixes her gaze on me.
Do your job, white girl, she says.
The judge takes the bench and recalls Ruth's case. Ruth is brought up from the bowels of the building again and takes a spot beside me. She gives me a questioning look and I nod. He's all right.
Ms. McQuarrie,
the judge sighs.
Have you had ample time to speak with your client?
Yes, Your Honor. Just days ago, Ruth Jefferson was a nurse at Mercy West Haven Hospital, caring for women in labor and their newborns as she has for the past 20 years. When a medical emergency occurred involving a baby, Ruth worked with the rest of the hospital personnel trying to save the child's life. Tragically, it was not meant to be. In the pending investigation surrounding what happened, Ruth was suspended from her job. She is a college graduate, her son is an honors student. Her husband is a military hero who gave his life for our country in Afghanistan. She has family in the community and equity in the house she lives in. I asked the court to set reasonable bail. My client is not a flight risk. She has no prior record. She's willing to abide by any particular conditions the court wants to set on her bail. This is a very defendable case. I've painted Ruth as an upstanding American citizen who has been misunderstood. Just about the only thing I don't do is take out an American flag and start waving it around. The judge turns to Ruth.
How much equity are we talking about?
I beg your pardon? What's the value of the mortgage on your house? I ask. $100,000, Ruth replies. The judge nods.
I'm going to set bail at $100,000. As a condition of the bail, I'll accept the house being posted. Next case.
The white supremacist supporters in the gallery start booing. I'm not sure they'd be happy with any verdict short of a public lynching. The judge calls for order and bangs his gavel.
Clear them out, he finally says,
and bailiffs begin to move through the aisles.
What happens now? Ruth asks.
You're getting out.
Thank God. How long will it take?
I glance up. A couple of days. A bailiff takes Ruth's arm to bring her back to the holding cell. As she is being led away, that curtain behind her eyes slips, and for the first time I see panic. It's not like it is on TV and in the movies. You don't just walk out of the courthouse free. There are papers to be procured and bondsmen to be dealt with.
I know that because I'm a public defender. Most of my clients know that because they tend to be repeat offenders. But Ruth, she's not like most of my clients. She's not even one of my clients when you get down to it. I've been with the public defender's office now for almost 4 years, and I've moved out of misdemeanors. I've done so many burglary cases and criminal mischief and identity theft and bad checks that at this point, I could probably argue them in my sleep. But this is a murder case, a high-profile trial that will be plucked out of my hands as soon as the court date is set. It will go to someone in my office who has more experience than I do, or who plays golf with my boss, or who has a penis. In the long run, I won't be Ruth's lawyer. But right now, I still am, and I can help her. I wing a silent thank you to the white supremacists who've created this uproar. Then I run down the central aisle of the gallery to Edison and his aunt. Listen, you need to get a certified copy of Ruth's house deed, I tell her sister, and a certified copy of the tax assessment and a copy of your sister's most recent mortgage payment, which shows what the current payoff is, and you need to bring that to the clerk's office. I realize that Ruth's sister is staring at me like I've suddenly started to speak Hungarian. But then again, she lives in Church Street South. She does not own her own place. This might as well be a foreign language to her. Then I realize that Edison is writing down everything I've said on the back of a receipt from his wallet. I'll figure it out, he promises. I give him my card. This is my cell number. If you have any questions, you can call me. But I won't be the one trying your mother's case. Someone else from my office will be in touch with you after she gets out. This admission snaps Ruth's sister back into action. So that's it? You put up her house to get her out of jail, so your good deed is done now? I guess since my sister's black, she obviously did the crime and you'd rather not get your hands dirty, right? This is ridiculous on so many levels, not the least of which is that the majority of my clients are African American. But before I can explain the hierarchy of politics in the public defender's office, Edison intercedes. Auntie, chill out. Then he turns to me. I'm sorry. No, I tell him. I am. When I finally get home that night, my mother is sitting with her stocking feet tucked beneath her, watching Disney Junior on television, a glass of white wine in her hand. She has had a glass of white wine every night for as long as I can remember. When I was little, she called it her medicine. Beside her on the couch is Violet, curled on her side, fast asleep. I didn't have the heart to move her, my mother says. I sit down gingerly beside my daughter, take the bottle of wine that's on the coffee table and drink from its neck. My mother's eyebrows arch. That bad? She asks. You have no idea. I stroke Violet's hair. You must have tired her out today. Well, my mother hesitates. We had a little bit of a blow-up at dinner. Was it the fish sticks? She won't eat them since going on her little mermaid kick. No, she ate them, and you'll be delighted to know that Ariel has left the building. In fact, that was what got her all hot and bothered. We started watching Princess and the Frog, and Violet informed me that she wants to be Tiana for Halloween. Thank God, I say. She was dead set on wearing a shell bikini top a week ago, and the only way that was going to happen was if it was over her long underwear. My mother raises her brows. Kennedy, she says, don't you think Violet would be happier as Cinderella? Or Rapunzel, or even that new one with the white hair who makes everything ice over. Elsa? I fill in. Why? Don't make me say it out loud, sugar, my mother replies. You mean because Tiana's black? I say. Immediately I think of Ruth Jefferson, of the white supremacists booing in the gallery. I don't think Violet is making a statement about equality as much as she is about frogs.
She told me she's going to ask for one as a pet for Christmas and kiss it and see what happens.
She's not getting a frog for Christmas, but if she wants to be Tiana for Halloween, I'll buy her the costume.
I will sew her the costume, my mother corrects. No grandbaby of mine is going trick-or-treating in a store-bought piece of trash that would probably go up in flames if she walked past a jack-o'-lantern.
I don't fight her on this. I can't even sew a seam. I have a pair of work trousers in my closet that are hemmed with super glue.
Terrific. I'm glad you can overcome your resistance in order to make Violet's dream come true.
My mother lifts her chin a notch.
I did not tell you this so you could scold me, Kennedy. Just because I grew up in the South doesn't make me prejudiced.
Mom, I point out,
you had a black nanny. And I adored Beatty like she was family,
my mother says.
Except she wasn't.
My mother pours more wine into her glass.
Kennedy, she sighs. It's just a silly costume, not a cause.
Suddenly, I'm so incredibly tired. It's not just the pace of my job or the overwhelming number of cases I have that wears me down. It's wondering if anything I do actually makes a difference.
Once, my mother says, her voice soft, when I was about Violet's age and Beatty wasn't looking, I tried to drink out of the colored water fountain at the park. I stepped up on the cement block and turned the knob. I was expecting something extraordinary. I was expecting rainbows. But you know, it was just like everyone else's water.
She meets my gaze.
Violet would make the most beautiful little Cinderella.
Mom,
I'm just saying, it took how many years for Disney to give all those little black girls their own princess? You think it's right for Violet to want something they've been waiting on forever?
Mom, she lifts her hands in concession. Fine, Tiana, done. I lift the bottle of wine, tilt it up, and drink down every last drop.
After my mother leaves, I fall asleep on the couch with Violet, and when I wake up, The Lion King is being aired on Disney Junior. I blink just in time to see the death of Mufasa playing out on screen. He is being trampled by the water buffalo just as Micah walks in, pulling off the garrote of his tie with one hand.
Hey, I say, I didn't hear you drive up.
Because I am a ninja, ingeniously masquerading as an ophthalmological surgeon. He leans down and kisses me, smiles at Violet, who is softly snoring.
My day was full of glaucoma and vitreous fluid. How was yours?
Considerably less gross, I say.
Did Crazy Sharon come back?
Crazy Sharon is a repeat offender. A stalker who has a thing for Peter Salovey, the president of Yale University. She leaves him flowers, love notes, and once, underwear. I've done 6 arraignments with her, and Salovey has been president only since 2013.
No, I say. And I tell him about Ruth and Edison and the skinheads in the gallery.
Really?
Micah is most interested in the last.
Like, with suspenders and flight jackets and the boots and everything?
Number one, no. And number two, should I be scared that you know all that?
I move my feet on the coffee table so he can sit down opposite me.
In fact, they looked just like us. It's pretty terrifying. I mean, what if your next-door neighbor was a white supremacist and you didn't know it?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Mrs. Greenblatt is not a skinhead,
Micah says. As he talks, he gently lifts Violet into his arms.
It's all a moot point anyway. It's too big a case for me to be assigned,
I tell him, climbing the stairs to our daughter's bedroom. And then I add,
Ruth Jefferson lives in East End.
Huh,
Micah replies. He settles Vi into her bed and pulls up her covers, dropping a kiss on her forehead. What's that supposed to mean? I ask, combative, even though I had the same sort of reaction.
It's not supposed to mean anything, Micah says. It was just a response.
What you really mean, but you're too polite to say, is that there aren't black families in East End.
I guess. Maybe.
I follow him into our room and unzip my skirt, peel off my pantyhose. When I'm wearing the t-shirt and boxers I usually sleep in, I go into the bathroom to brush my teeth beside Micah. I spit, wipe my mouth on the back of my hand. Did you know that in The Lion King, the hyenas, the bad guys, all speak in either black or Latino slang? And that the little cubs are told not to go where the hyenas live? He looks at me, amused. Do you realize that Scar, the villain, is darker than Mufasa?
Kennedy?
Micah puts his hands on my shoulders, leans down, and kisses me.
There is a slight chance you're overthinking this.
That's the moment I know I'm going to move heaven and earth to be Ruth's public defender.
Turk. I'm guessing this lawyer's pretty decent given how swanky his office is. The walls aren't painted, they're paneled. The glass of water his secretary gets me is a heavy crystal tumbler. Even the air smells rich, like the perfume of a lady who would normally shy away from me on a public street. I'm wearing again today the jacket Francis and I share, and I've ironed my pants. I have a wool cap pulled low on my head, and I keep twirling my wedding ring around and around on my finger. I could pass for any ordinary Joe who wants to sue someone, instead of a guy who would normally skirt the legal system and take justice into his own hands. Suddenly, Rourke Matthews is standing in front of me. His suit is ironed with knife-edge pleats. His shoes are buffed to a high gloss. He looks like a soap opera star, except that his nose is a little off-kilter, like he broke it playing football in high school. He holds out a hand to greet me. Mr. Bauer, he says, why don't you come with me? He leads me into an even more imposing office, this one full of black leather and chrome, and gestures to a spot on the love seat. Let me say again how sorry I am for your loss, Matthews says, like everyone else does these days. The words have gotten so ordinary, in fact, that they feel like rain. I hardly even notice them anymore. On the phone, we talked about the possibility of filing a civil suit. Whatever it's called, I interrupt. I just want someone to pay for this. Ah, Matthews says. And that is why I asked you to come in here. You see, it's quite complicated. What's so complicated? You sue the nurse. She's the one who did this. Matthews hesitates. You could sue Ruth Jefferson, he agrees. But let's be realistic. She doesn't have a pot to piss in. As you know, there's a criminal prosecution underway that the state has undertaken. That means that if you file a civil suit simultaneously, Miss Jefferson would ask for a stay of all discovery so she couldn't incriminate herself during the pending criminal prosecution. And the fact that you filed a civil suit against her can be used against you in cross-examination during the criminal lawsuit. I don't understand. The defense will make you out to be a gold digger with a grudge, Matthews says bluntly. I sit back, my hands on my knees. So that's it? I don't have a case? I never said that, the lawyer replies. I just think you've chosen the wrong target. Unlike Ms. Jefferson, the hospital does have deep pockets. Moreover, they have an obligation to supervise their staff, and they are responsible for the nurse's actions or inactions. That's who I would recommend filing the lawsuit against. Now, we'd still name Ruth Jefferson. You never know. Right now, she has nothing. But tomorrow, she could win the lottery or receive an inheritance. He raises a brow. And then, Mr. Bauer, you might not just get justice. You might get a very handsome payout. I nod, imagining this. I think about being able to tell Britt how I'm going to do right by Davis. So what do we do to get started? Now? Matthews says. Nothing. Not until the criminal lawsuit is over. The civil suit will still be viable when it's done, and that way it can't be used to incriminate your character. He leans back, spreading his hands. Come back to me when the trial's over, Matthews says. I'm not going anywhere. At first, I didn't believe Francis when he said that the new wave of Anglo-supremacy would be a war fought not with fists but with ideas, spread subversively and anonymously through the internet. But all the same, I was smart enough not to tell him he was a crazy old coot. For one thing, he was still one of the legends of the movement. And more importantly, he was the father of the girl I couldn't get my mind off. Britt Mitchum was beautiful, but in a way that knocked me off my feet. She had the softest skin I'd ever touched, and pale blue eyes that she ringed with dark eyeliner. Unlike other skin chicks, she didn't buzz her hair at the crown and let wispy bangs frame her face and the back of her neck. Instead, Britt had thick hair that spilled down to the middle of her back. Sometimes she braided it, and the braid was as thick as my wrist. I thought a lot about what it would feel like to have those curls hanging over my face like a curtain as she kissed me. But the last thing I was going to do was make a move on a girl whose father could have my spine snapped by making a single phone call. So instead I went to visit. Often. I pretended to have a question for Francis, who liked seeing me because it gave him a chance to talk up his idea for an Anglo website. I helped him change the oil in his truck and fix the leaky garbage disposal for him. I made myself useful, but when it came to Britt, I worshipped from afar. So I was pretty blown away when one day she came out to a chopping block where I was splitting wood for Francis. "So," she says, "are the rumors true?" "What rumors?" I asked. "They say you took down a whole motorcycle gang and that you killed your own father." "In that case, no," I said. "Then you're just a little pussy like the other guys who like to pretend they're big bad Anglos so they can bask in my daddy's glow." Shocked, I looked up at her and saw her mouth twitch. I raised the axe over my head, flexed my muscles, and sent the axe hurtling into the piece of wood, which cleaved neatly. "I like to think I fall somewhere between the two extremes," I said. "Maybe I want to see for myself." She took a step closer. "Next time your crew goes on the hunt." I laughed. There is no way I'm taking Francis Mitchum's daughter out with my guys. "Why not?" "Because you're Francis Mitchum's daughter." That's not an answer. Hell, yes it was, even if she couldn't see it. "My father's been taking me out with his crew my whole life." Somehow I found that hard to believe. Later I found out it was true, but he left Britt buckled into her car seat, sound asleep in the back of his truck. "You're not tough enough to run with my crew," I said, just to get her off my back. When she didn't reply, I figured that was that. I lifted the axe again and started the downswing, only to have Britt dart lightning fast into the path of the blade. Immediately I let go of the shaft, feeling the axe spin out of my hands to wedge itself deeply in the ground about 6 inches away from her. "Jesus fucking Christ!" I shouted. "What is wrong with you?" "Not tough enough," she replied. "Thursday," I told her, "after dark." Every night, I hear my son cry. The sound wakes me up, which is how I know he's a ghost. Britt never hears him. But then she is still floating in a haze of sleeping pills and oxy left over from when I busted my knee. I get out of bed and take a piss and follow the noise, which gets louder and louder and louder, and then disappears when I reach the living room. There's no one there, just the computer screen, green and glaring at me. I sit down on the couch and I drink a six-pack, and still I can hear my boy crying. My father-in-law gives me almost 2 weeks of grieving, and then starts dumping out all the beer in the house. One night, Francis comes to find me when I'm sitting on the living room couch, my head in my hands, trying to drown out the baby's sobs. I think for a minute he's going to deck me. He may be an old dude, but he could still take me. But instead he yanks the laptop from its power cord and throws it at me. "Get even," he says simply, and he walks back into his side of the duplex. For a long time, I just sit there, the computer pressed up next to me like a girl who's begging for a dance. I can't say I reach for it. More like, it makes its way back home to me. With the touch of a key, a web page loads. I haven't been here since before Britt had the baby. When Francis and I teamed up to create our website, I read manuals on coding and metadata while Francis fed me the material we would post. We called our site Lone Wolf, because that was what we all had to become. This was no longer the 80s. We were losing our best men to the prison system. The old guard was getting too old to curb stomp and wield nunchucks. The fresh cuts were too plugged in to get excited about a KKK rally, where a bunch of ancient yahoos sat around drinking and talking about the good old days. They didn't want to hear an old wives' tale like that black people stank when their hair got wet. They wanted statistics they could take back to their lefty teachers and relatives who got tangled in knots when they said we were the real victims of discrimination in this country. So we gave them what they asked for. We posted the truth, that the U.S. Census Bureau said whites would be a minority by 2043, that 40% of black people who were on welfare could work but didn't, that the fact that the Zionist occupation government was taking over our nation could be traced right to Alan Greenspan at the Federal Reserve. LoneWolf.org quickly became something bigger than itself. We were the younger, hipper alternative, the fresh edge of rebellion. Now my hands move across the keyboard while I log in as the administrator. Part of the reason for running this site is the anonymity, the ability to hide behind what I believe. We are all anonymous here, and we are also all brothers. This is my army of nameless, faceless friends. But today, all that is about to change. Many of you know me by my blog posts and have responded with your own comments. Like me, you are a true patriot. Like me, you wanted to follow an idea, not a person. But today, I am going to step into the light because I want you to know me. I want you to know what happened to me. My name is Turk Bauer, I type. And I am going to tell you the story of my son. After I hit the post button, I watch the story of my son's short, brave life hover on the computer screen. I want to believe that if he had to die, it was for a cause. It was for our cause. I do not drink that night, and I do not fall back asleep. Instead, I watch the numerical counter at the top of the header, which marks each page view. One reader, 6 readers, 37 readers, 409 readers. By the time the sun comes up, more than 13,000 people know Davis's name. I make coffee and scroll through the comments section as I drink my first cup. I'm so sorry for your loss. Your boy was a race warrior. Goddamn blue gum shouldn't have been allowed to work in a white hospital anyhow. I've made a donation in your son's name to the American Freedom Party. But one of them stops me cold. Romans chapter 12, verse 19, it read, "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord." The Thursday after Britt dodged my axe, I had dinner with her and her father. We were well into dessert before Britt looked up, as if she just remembered something she needed to tell us. "I hit a nigger with my car today," she announced. Francis reared back in his seat. "Well, what was he doing in front of your car?" "I have no idea. Walking, I guess. But he dented the front fender." "I can take a look at it," I said. "I've done some body work." A smile played around Britt's mouth. "I bet you have." I turned 30 shades of red while Britt told her dad that she'd convinced me to take her to see a movie after dinner, some chick flick. Francis clapped me on the back.
"Better you than me, son," he said. And then we were in my car, about to make a night of it.
Britt was like a live wire, buzzing in the passenger seat. She couldn't stop talking. She couldn't stop asking questions. Where were we going? Who would we target? Had I been there before? The way I figured it, either tonight went well and that earned me Britt's undying respect, or tonight went poorly and her father broke my neck for putting her in danger.
I took her to an abandoned parking lot near a hot dog stand that was pretty popular with faggots, who sometimes met here to hook up in the bushes behind. Seriously, though, could there be any greater cliche than gay guys meeting at a wiener stand? They deserve to be beaten up for that alone. I had thought about messing up some coons, but they were basically animals and could be pretty strong in a fight, whereas even Brit could pound a pansy.
"Are the other guys meeting us here?" she asked.
"There are no other guys," I admitted. "I used to have a crew, but after one of them turned on me, I realized I like working alone. That's how the rumor started about the bikers. The only reason I took down a whole gang by myself is because I can't trust anyone else."
"I get it," Britt said. "It sucks to be abandoned by the people who are supposed to support you."
I glanced at her. "Somehow I think you've lived a pretty privileged life."
"Yeah, except for the part where my mother up and left me behind when I was a baby, like I was just trash."
I knew Francis didn't have a wife, but I didn't know what had happened. "Man, that sucks. I'm sorry." To my surprise, Britt wasn't upset. She was furious.
"I'm not." Her eyes burned like coals in a fire. "Daddy said she ran off with a nigger."
Just then, two men walked up to the hot dog stand to order. They got their dogs and walked over to a half-broken picnic table.
"You ready?"
I asked Britt.
"I was born ready."
I hid my smile. Was I ever that brave? We got out of my car and sauntered across the street as if we were going to grab a bite, too. But instead, I stopped at the picnic table and smiled pleasantly. "Hey, either of you limp wrists got a cigarette?" They exchanged a glance. I love that glance. It's the same one you see on an animal when it realizes it's been cornered.
"Let's just go," the blonde one said to the short, skinny dude.
"See, that doesn't work for me," I said, stepping closer, "because I'll still know you're out there." I grabbed Blondie by the throat and punched his lights out. He went down like a stone. I turned to watch Britt, who had jumped on the skinny guy's back and was riding him like a nightmare. Her fingernails raked across his cheek, and as he stumbled to the ground, she started kicking him in the kidneys, then straddled him, lifted his head, and smashed it back down on the pavement. I had fought beside women before. There's a common misconception that skin chicks are subservient, barefoot, and pregnant most of the time. But if you're going to be a skinhead girl, you have to be a tough bitch. Britt might not have gotten her hands dirty before, but she was a natural. When she was pounding on a slack, unconscious body, I hauled her upright. "Come on," I urged, and together we ran to the car. We drove to a hill that offered a great view of planes taking off and landing at Tweed Airport. The runway lights winked at us as we sat on the hood of the car, Britt swimming in adrenaline.
"God!" she yelled, tipping her throat to the night sky. "That was unfucking believable! It felt like...
She couldn't find a word, but I could. I knew what it was like to have so much bottled up inside that you had to explode. I knew what it was like to cause pain for a few seconds instead of feeling it. The source of Britt's restlessness might be different from mine, but she had been reined in all the same, and she'd just found the breach in the fence. "It feels like freedom," I said.
"Yes," she breathed, staring at me. "Do you ever feel like you don't belong in your own skin? Like you were meant to be someone else?"
"All the time," I thought. But instead of saying that, I leaned over and kissed her. She spun so that she was sitting on me, facing me. She kissed me harder, biting my lip, devouring. Her hands were under the tail of my shirt, fumbling with the buttons of my jeans. "Hey," I said, trying to grab her wrists. "There's no rush."
"Yes, there is,"
she whispered into my neck. She was on fire, and if you get too close to a fire, you go up in flames too. So I let her slip beneath my zipper. I helped her hike up her skirt and rip off her panties. Britt lowered herself onto me, and I moved inside her like the start of something. On the morning of the arraignment, I get dressed while Britt is still sleeping in the pajamas she's worn for the past 4 days.
I eat a bowl of cereal and I prepare myself for war. At the courthouse are about 20 friends I didn't know I had. They are loyal followers of Lone Wolf, frequent posters on my site, men and women who read about Davis and wanted to do more than just type their sympathy. Like me, they don't look the way most people would expect a skinhead to look. No one is bald, except me. They're all wearing ordinary clothing. Some have tiny sunwheel pins on their collars. Many wear a baby blue ribbon for Davis. Some pat my shoulder or call me by my name. Others just nod, the tiniest inclination of their heads to let me know they are here for me as I pass down the aisle. Just then a nigger comes up to me. I nearly shove her away when she starts talking, a knee-jerk reaction. And then I realize I know her voice and that she's the prosecutor. I have talked to Odette Lawton on the phone, but she didn't sound black. This feels like a slap, like some kind of conspiracy. Maybe this is a good thing. It's no surprise that the liberals who run the court system have it out for Anglos, and there's no way we could ever get a fair trial because of it. They'll make this about me instead of that nurse, but if the lawyer who's on my side is black, well, then I can't possibly be prejudiced, can I? They'll never have to know what I'm really thinking. Someone reads the judge's name, DuPont, which doesn't sound like some Jew name, which is a good start. Then I sit through four other defendants before they call the name Ruth Jefferson. The courtroom sizzles like a griddle. People start booing and raising up signs with my son's face on them, a picture I uploaded to the website, the only one I have of him. Then the nurse is brought in, wearing a nightgown and shackles on her wrists. She is looking around the gallery. I wonder if she's trying to find me. I decide to make it easy for her. In one swift movement, I'm on my feet and leaning over the low railing that separates us from the lawyers and the stenographer. I take a deep breath and hurl a gob of spit that smacks the bitch on the side of the face. I can tell the second she recognizes me. Instantly, I am flanked by bailiffs who drag me out of the courtroom, but that's okay too. Because even as I'm pulled away, the nurse will see the swastika sneaking down the back of my scalp. It's okay to lose a battle when you are in it to win the war. The two meathead bailiffs dump me outside the heavy doors of the courthouse. "Don't think about coming back in," one warns, and then they disappear inside. I rest my hands on my knees, catching my breath. I may not have access to the courtroom, but this is a free country as far as I know. They can't keep me from staying here and watching Ruth Jefferson get carted to jail. Resolved, I look up, and that's when I see them. The vans with satellite dishes. The reporters smoothing their skinny skirts and testing their microphones. The media that has come to report on this case. The lawyer said they needed a grieving parent, not an angry parent. I can give them that. But first, I pull out my cell phone and call Francis at home. Get Britt out of bed and park her in front of the television. I glance at the news vans. Channel 4. Then I take a cap out of my pocket, the one I wore into the courthouse this morning so I wouldn't draw attention to my tattoo until I wanted to. I center it on my head. I think about Davis, because that's all I need to make tears come to my eyes. You saw that, right? I approach a slant reporter I've seen on NBC. You saw me get thrown out of that building? She glances at me.
Yeah. Sorry, but we're here to cover a different story.
I know, I say. But I'm the father of the dead baby. I tell the reporter that Britt and I had been so excited about our first baby. I say I'd never seen anything as perfect as his tiny hands, his nose, which looked just like Britt's. I say that my wife is still so upset over what happened to Davis that she can't get out of bed, can't even be here today at court. I say it is a tragedy for someone who has taken a vow to heal, to intentionally kill a helpless infant just because she is upset at being removed from a patient's care. I understand we didn't see eye to eye, I say, looking at the reporter. But that doesn't mean my son deserved to die.
What do you hope the outcome will be, Mr. Bauer?
She asks. I want my son back, I tell her, but that isn't going to happen.
Then I excused myself. Truth is, I'm starting to choke up thinking about Davis. And I'm not going to be broadcast blubbering like a girl. I duck away from the other reporters, who are now falling all over each other to speak to me. But they get distracted as the doors to the courthouse open and Odette Lawton exits. She starts talking about how this is a heinous crime, how the state will make sure that justice is done. I slip along the side of the building, past where a janitor is smoking a cigarette, to a loading dock in the back. This, I know, leads to a lower-level door which leads to the holding cells. I can't get inside, there are guards posted. But I stand at a distance, huddled against the wind, until a van pulls out with the words, York Correctional Institution, printed on its side. That's the only prison for women in this state, in Niantic. It's where the nurse must be headed. At the last minute, I step into its path, so that the driver has to swerve. I know, inside that van, Ruth Jefferson will be jolted by that motion, that she'll look out the window to see what caused it, that the last thing she sees before prison will be me. After I took Britt Wilding, I became a regular visitor in her home, and I pretty much ran the website from Francis's living room. On Lone Wolf, we hosted discussions, tax forums that pitted Joe Legal, the white worker, against Jose, the illegal job thief. Threads about why our economy was being ruined by Obama. An online book club. A section for creative writing and poetry, which included a 300-page alternate ending to the Civil War. There was a section for Anglo women to connect with each other, and another for teens, which helped them navigate situations like what to do when a friend said he was gay. End the friendship immediately, or explain that no one is born that way and the trend will vanish eventually. There were opinion topics. Which is worse, a white gay or a straight black? Which universities are the most anti-white? Our most popular thread was the one about forming a white nationalist K-12 school. We had over 1 million posts there. But we also had a section of the site where we gave suggestions of what people could do individually or within their cells if they wanted to take action without promoting outright violence. Mostly, we found ways to get minorities all twisted up believing that there was an army of us in their midst, when in reality, it was just one or two people. Francis and I practiced what we preached. We adopted a stretch of highway in a mostly black area and posted a sign that said it was being maintained by the KKK. One night we drove to the Jewish Community Center in West Hartford. During Friday night services, we slipped a flyer under the windshield wiper of each car in the parking lot. A photo of Adolf Hitler in full Sieg Heil, and underneath it in bold letters, "The Holocaust was a hoax." On the back were bullets of facts. Zyklon B was a delousing agent. For it to be used as a gas would have required huge amounts and airtight chambers, neither of which were present at the camps. There were no remains of mass murders at the camps. Where were the bone and teeth fragments? Where were the piles of ashes? American incinerators burn one body in 8 hours, but two crematoria in Auschwitz burn 25,000 bodies a day? Impossible. The Red Cross inspected the camps every 3 months and made plenty of complaints, none of which mentioned gassing millions of Jews. The liberal Jewish media has perpetuated this myth to advance their agenda. By the next morning, the Hartford Current would run an article about the neo-Nazi element that was infiltrating this community. Parents would be worried for their children. Everyone would be on edge. That was exactly how we liked it. We didn't have to terrorize anyone as long as we could scare the shit out of them. "Well," Francis said as we were driving back to the duplex, "that was a good night's work." I nodded, but I kept my eyes on the road. Francis had a thing about that. He wouldn't let me drive with the radio on, for example, in case I got too easily distracted. "I got a question for you, Turk," he said. I waited for him to ask me how he could get top placement for Lone Wolf in a Google search, or if we could stream podcasts, but instead he turned to me. "When are you going to make an honest woman out of my daughter?" I nearly swallowed my tongue. I would be honored to do that. He looked at me, appraising. Good. Do it soon. As it turned out, it took a while. I wanted it to be perfect, so I asked around on Lone Wolf for suggestions. One guy had gotten all decked out in full SS regalia to propose. Another took his beloved to the site of their first real date, but I didn't think a hot dog stand with gay guys blowing each other in the woods was a terrific setting. Several posters got into a vehement fight about whether or not an engagement ring was necessary, since Jews ran the diamond industry. In the end, I decided to just tell her how I felt. So one day I picked her up and drove her back to my place.
Really?
She said.
You're going to cook?
I thought maybe we could do it together, I suggested as we walked into the kitchen. I turned away because I thought for sure she would see how terrified I was.
What are we having?
Well, don't be disappointed. I held out a container of hummus. On top I had written, "There are no words to tell you how much I love you." She laughed.
Cute.
I handed her an ear of corn and mimed shucking it. She pulled down the husk and a note fell out. "I think you're amazing." Grinning, she held out her hand for more. I gave her a bottle of ketchup with a sticker on the back. "I love you from my head to my toes." "That's pushing it," Britt said, smiling. I was limited by the season. I passed her a stick of margarine. "You're my butter half." Then I opened the fridge. On the top shelf, there were four zucchini propped up to form the letter M, three carrots creating an A, two curved bananas, RR, and a piece of ginger root, Y. On the next shelf was a cellophane-wrapped package of chopped meat that I'd shaped into the letters M-E. On the bottom shelf was a squash with Britt's name carved into it. Britt covered her mouth with her hand as I dropped to my knee. I handed her a ring box. Inside was a blue topaz, which was exactly the color of her eyes. "Say yes," I begged. She slipped the ring onto her hand as I stood. "I was kind of expecting a hefty twist tie after all that," Britt said, and she threw her arms around me. We kissed, and I hiked her up on the counter. She wrapped her legs around me. I thought about spending the rest of my life with Britt. I thought about our kids, how they would look just like her, how they'd have a father who was a million times better than mine had been. An hour later, when we lay in each other's arms on the kitchen floor, on a pile of our clothes, I gathered Britt close. "I'm assuming that's a yes," I said. Her eyes lit up and she ran to the fridge, returning a few seconds later. "Yes," she said, "but first you have to promise me something."
"We?"
She dropped a melon into my hands. "Cantaloupe." When I come back from court and walk into the house, the television is still on. Francis meets me at the door and I look at him, a question on my lips. Before I can ask, though, I see that Britt is sitting in the living room on the floor, her face inches away from the screen. The midday news is on, and there is Odette Lawton talking to reporters. Britt turns, and for the first time since our son was born, for the first time in weeks, she smiles. "Baby," she says, bright and beautiful and mine again. "Baby, you're a star."
Ruth. They put me in chains. Just like that, they shackle my hands in front of me, as if that doesn't send 200 years of history running through my veins like an electric current. As if I can't feel my great-great-grandmother and her mother standing on an auction block. They put me in chains, and my son, who I've told every day since he was born, "You are more than the color of your skin." My son watches. It is more humiliating than being in public in my nightgown, than having to urinate without privacy in the holding cell, than being spit at by Turk Bauer, than having a stranger speak for me in front of a judge. She had asked me if I touched the baby, and I'd lied to her. Not that I thought, at this point, that I still had a job to save, but because I just couldn't think fast enough what the right answer would be, the one that might set me free. And because I didn't trust this stranger sitting across from me, when I was nothing more to her than the other 20 clients she would see today. I listened to this lawyer, Kennedy something, I've already forgotten her last name, volley back and forth with another lawyer. The prosecutor, who's a woman of color, does not even make eye contact with me. I wonder if this is because she feels nothing but contempt for me, an alleged criminal, or because she knows if she wants to be taken seriously, she has to widen the canyon between us. True to her word, Kennedy gets me bail. Just like that, I want to hug this woman, thank her. What happens now, I ask, as the people in the courtroom hear the decision and become a living, breathing thing. You're getting out, she tells me. Thank God. How long will it take? I'm expecting minutes, an hour at the most. There must be paperwork, which I can then lock away to prove that this was all a misunderstanding. A couple of days, Kennedy says. Then a beefy guard has my arm and firmly pushes me back to the rabbit warren of holding cells in the basement of this godforsaken building. I wait in the same cell I was taken to during the recess in court. I count all the cinder blocks in the wall. 360. I count them again. I think about that spider of a tattoo on Turk Bauer's head, and how I hadn't believed he could possibly be worse than he already was. But I was wrong. I don't know how much time passes before Kennedy comes. What's going on? I explode. I can't stay here for days. She talks about mortgage deeds and percentages, numbers that swim in my head. I know you're worried about your son. I'm sure your sister will keep an eye on him. A sob swells like a song in my throat. I think about my sister's home, where her boys talk back to their dad when he tells them to take out the trash, where dinner is not a conversation but takeout Chinese with the television blaring. I think about Edison texting me at work, things like reading Lolita for AP English, Nabokov equals seriously messed up dude. So I stay here, I ask. You'll be taken to the prison. Prison? A chill runs down my spine. But I thought I got bail. You did. But the wheels of justice move exceedingly slow, and you have to stay until the bail is processed. Suddenly a guard I haven't seen before appears at the door of the cell. Coffee clatch is over, ladies, he says. Kennedy looks at me, her words fast and fierce like bullets. Don't talk about your charges. People are going to try to work a deal by prying information out of you. Don't trust anyone. Including you, I wonder. The guard opens the door of the cell and tells me to hold out my arms. There are those shackles and chains again. Is that really necessary? Kennedy asks. I don't make the rules, the guard says. I'm led down another hallway to a loading dock, where a van is waiting. Inside is another woman in chains. She's wearing a tight dress and glitter eyeliner and has a weave that reaches halfway down her back. You like what you see? She asks, and I immediately avert my eyes. The sheriff climbs in the front seat of the van and starts the engine. Officer, the woman says, I'm a girl who loves her jewelry, but these bracelets are cramping my style. When he doesn't respond, she rolls her eyes. I'm Liza, she says. Liza Lott. I can't help it. I laugh. That's really your name? It better be, since I picked it. I like it so much better than Bruce. She purses her lips, staring at me, waiting for my reaction. My eyes move from her large manicured hands to her stunning face. If she's expecting me to be shocked, she has another thing coming. I'm a nurse. I have literally seen it all, including a trans man who became pregnant when his wife was infertile, and a woman with two vaginas. I meet her gaze, refusing to be intimidated. I'm Ruth. You get your Subway sandwich, Ruth? What? The food, sugar. It's so much better in court than in jail, am I right? I shake my head. I've never done this before. Me, I should have a punch card. You know, the kind where you get a free coffee or a tiny tube of mascara at your 10th visit. She grins. What are you in for? I wish I knew, I say. Before I can remember not to. What the fuck, girl? You were in the courtroom. You were arraigned, Liza replies. You didn't hear what you were charged with? I turn away, focusing on the scenery out the window. My lawyer told me I shouldn't talk to anyone about that. Well, she sniffs, pardon me, Your Majesty.